This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Talking about chicken a la king,
mango and garbanzo tabbouleh,
real potatoes and vegetables with roasted garlic and basil,
zucchini ziti,
granola fruit bar.
Look at all this beautiful food.
Welcome to Green Eggs and Dan, where I interview amazing people with amazing minds, but all I care about is what is in their fridge. Very excited about my guest today. One of the most famous food podcasters in the world. He hosts the James Beard Award-winning show, The Sporkful. He is the creator and host of the Food Network's You're Eating It Wrong. And is it Food Network or Cooking Channel? Which one was that on?
Cooking Channel.
Cooking Channel. You're Eating It Wrong. Parent company is Food Network. And he created a new pasta shape. That is the most impressive thing about your bio, Dan. Cascatelli, which he says is the ideal pasta shape. Shots fired, Radiatori. Please welcome Dan Pashman is here. Hi, Dan. How are you?
Hey, Dan. It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
Of course. I'm so excited to have you here. You created the space of the non-pretentious food podcast. So I would say you walked so that I could run, but you're running faster than I'm running. So you sprinted so that I could jog.
I don't know that it's a race in any case, but yeah, I mean, look, you know, my background is in radio and audio. That's sort of what I came up in. I always sort of wanted to host my own radio show. I hosted a show on an internet radio station called RadioBoston.com in about 2000. This was long before smartphones or even iPods, and you had to listen through a laptop to be able to listen to this streaming radio station. You can imagine why it didn't succeed. Point is that I had my sights set on audio for a long time, so it sort of came up that way and stumbled into food.
Yeah. Well, you stumbled in nicely because I can't believe I'm about to say this. We might have the nicest fridge that I've seen.
Really?
In the hundreds of episodes of Green Eggs and Dan thus far. You guys can see Dan's fridge on my Instagram at StandUpDan. This is a pretty damn near perfect fridge.
I didn't plan it, but actually you're right. I mean, you caught me on a pretty good day. It looks more organized than my life feels.
I mean, the symmetry, the colors, I mean, even the bend in the QP mayo bottle, just everything is very, very perfect here. Let's start with the top row here. So automatically, the thing that comes out is you've got these very brown bananas. I'm assuming you're saving for banana bread. That's what all the fancy food people do.
Well, my wife usually is the banana bread baker in the house, and that is why she was saving those. But those did not make it to banana bread. You know, at a certain point, they cross over when they're disintegrating on the shelf.
Yeah,
and that's... those met an untimely demise.
Even so, it still doesn't take away from the beauty of this fridge. This fridge is a living organism, all right? Yeah. Things live, things die.
Right, right.
Behind that, you've got the Kedem kosher wine.
That's kosher grape juice. That's for, we typically do Shabbat dinner. My family's Jewish, so we're not super religious, but we do Shabbat dinner almost every Friday with our kids, and so they get grape juice.
Okay, got it. And then we have the bust of cucumbers over here.
Yes, I believe they're usually sold as under the Persian cucumber label.
Yes. But
yeah, my daughter Emily in particular loves those. She loves Caesar salad. She loves cucumbers dipped in Caesar dressing. Lately, I taught her about scooping out the seeds from the cucumber and putting things inside. Like she's been into cottage cheese, so she'll scoop out the cucumber and put cottage cheese in, make a little boat. So those are mostly for Emily and my older daughter Becky.
And as a Persian, I appreciate that.
Yeah,
I get a residual every time someone buys Persian cucumbers.
I put that in for you, Dan.
Thank you. I appreciate it. On the second row here, we have this is the. The pasta, all the pasta. This is the Museum of Pasta.
Yeah.
I see some tortellini over here. And then I see probably the biggest spiral pastas I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, at a glance you might say, oh, that's fusilli. But it's not fusilli, it's fusilloni. And I think that fusilli is a garbage pasta shape. That's the corkscrew spiral. It never cooks evenly. The edges turn to mush while the center spine is still hard. Mm. It actually has too much surface area. Sauce overwhelms it, and the whole thing will eventually turn to mush pretty quickly. But if you get fusilloni, which are basically like giant fusillis, then everything is just bigger and thicker and more durable, and it's one of my very favorite shapes.
Wait, is that something that you created, or this is an existing shape?
That's an existing shape. Yeah, you can get fusilloni. It's out there. Actually, there's some pretty big box stores that have like store brand versions that are fine. You know, if you can get it from like a Italian producer, sort of more, a little more upscale, you're like, you know, it's better wheat and all that. You get a little more flavor out of it, but it's a good shape anyway. So, I do love fusilloni. It's like it holds sauce the way you want fusilli to, but without falling apart the way fusilli does.
Hmm. I am a huge fan of the big pastas, and if I feel like Pakari is having a moment.
Yeah.
I'm seeing it a lot more in stores where I didn't see it before. It's basically, it's like penne on steroids. I feel like it's typically reserved for more seafoody pastas, but I don't know, man. I like it with everything.
You're a Pakari fan?
I love. It's so much fun.
It's like a short tube, usually not ridged, but it's very. I mean, but it's a short shape, but it's long by tube standards. It's more. I would say it's more like an extra thick, extra long rigatoni, but without ridges.
Right.
But it's so thick. I love how tooth sinkable it is that you can really like you can sink your teeth into it. It's extremely satisfying. Sometimes it's cut so big that I can't get it into my mouth, which I find kind of like that. Then what's the point of making it so big if you have to cut it in half? You might as well use a tube that's shorter. You know what I'm saying?
Look, I think it's like nigiri. It doesn't matter how big it is. You have to shove that whole thing in your mouth.
Do you have that issue with Pakari, Dan?
I don't think so. I don't know. I haven't thought about it, but I think I'm okay. Here's the thing. It's not the best at holding sauce at all. I mean, it just slips right through it. It's like the Midtown Tunnel. And but there's something very fun about it. I like the way it looks in the plate. I don't know. I'm a fan. I know it doesn't make much sense, but I'm
a
fan.
I love how tooth sinkable it is. And it doesn't bother me that it doesn't hold much sauce. I think it's more like that's a pasta shape that you want with more like stabbable preparations.
Yeah.
So when you wouldn't do Pakari with a thin, oily sauce. If you do it with big chunks, you stab around the plate, you get great bites. I just don't like when it gets too long. And then I feel like when it's so long, you might as well just do like there's a shape called mezze maniche that's similar to rigatoni. It's sort of like a shorter version of Pakari. It's like a half-length Pakari.
Oh.
Mezze maniche just means like short sleeves. And that's like, it's very similar, but a little bit more, a little easier to fit in your mouth.
I mean, we're going off on a pasta tangent here, and I'm okay with it because I love tangenting on things off of the fridge. But I do think, one, I was enamored by radiatore because it's very cute because it looks like a radiator. But yep. I do think that's a very good one at kind of, it's functionally a very good shape as well. I think it does have a lot of nooks and crannies for the pasta to go hide in. It's very fun, that shape.
Yeah, 100%. I agree. Radiatore is a good shape. Holds a lot of sauce. I like when you can get one that's a little bit bigger. You know, like as it comes out of the dye, it starts to curl. And you get some that are sort of like half a circle as they've curled around, a three-quarter. I like when you kind of get almost, it comes around to a full circle.
Yeah.
So it's almost like a tube that has a slit opening, but it's got all those spiny ruffles sticking out. I love those.
Love them. Now, you have some tortellinis here. Are these tortellini or?
Yeah, those are spinach and cheese tortellinis, refrigerated in the package. You know, the kids love those. They're good for whipping up for sometimes we send the kids to school with those for lunch, or you know, throw them together for dinner when we're in a pinch. It's an old reliable.
I have a feeling you're blaming all of the fun kid stuff on the kids, and you're actually at home having the tortellini with the Kedem wine yourself,
right?
With the grape juice
and the cucumbers, yeah,
and the cucumbers. You're like, ah, it's for the kids,
yeah.
Okay, and then what's this this yellowness over here?
That's orange liquid is soup. My wife Janie, she grew up in a very soup family. Like every sit down meal, like there's always soup. Every Shabbat dinner, every holiday, there's always soup. So she makes a lot of soup. She makes great soup. That one is probably some combination of carrot and squash, and are the main ingredients. That's why it's orange.
I was cooking last night, and I was just trying to empty the fridge. I had some carrots that were probably in my fridge for 6 months, I'm going to say.
Right.
And they still kind of, like, they don't get... Why do carrots never go bad, it seems?
Yeah, they're one of the more durable, vegetables out there. It's true. Yeah, carrots and potatoes. Potatoes last forever, too.
Yeah. Well, hopefully I don't die, but I ate them. over here in the door, you've got these fun... I just got like a 5-pack of these Japanese, like, they come in like a little toothpaste-y tube. They're like little Japanese condiments. I don't know how you describe them. This is probably the wasabi one, but they come in like different flavors. There's the yellow one. There's the red one. They're very fun. You can get them on Amazon. I love these.
Really? I haven't tried the other one. What are the other ones? I mean, yes, that is wasabi in my fridge, and it's like better than the wasabi that comes with the sushi when you order from a typical sort of sushi joint. I have my fancier soy sauce and fancier wasabi to go with the sushi that we get. But what are the other ones?
I have an orange one that is it's like some sort of mustard, and then they have like one that's like something spicy, like chili spicy. They've got pretty fun ones. I think there is like a 5-pack somewhere, but they are great. I'll send you the link of it once we get off here.
Yeah, I would love to check that out.
Okay, I'm going to have to ding you a little bit, if that's okay.
I'm ready. I can take it.
Okay, you are obviously a man of fantastic taste. You have wonderful products.
Okay.
You have, you've got a lot of fun, random stuff in here. And then you've got the basic bitch yellowtail Sauvignon Blanc or Chardonnay, I'm assuming. So Dan, you're better than this. You're better than this. And don't tell me it's for the kids.
I'm not really actually better than that. To be honest, I'm really not a wine drinker. I'm more of a beer and liquor drinker when I drink. I will occasionally have white wine. When I drink white wine, I'm often drinking it on the rocks, which I know is like blasphemy for like hardcore wine people. Although I once interviewed Jacques Pepin, the sort of the famous French TV host and chef. And after we finished taping, he was like, "You want some wine?" And I was like, I'm not going to turn down a chance to have wine with Jacques Pepin. And he poured his wine over ice. And so he's like, "Do you want ice?" I was like, "Sure, I'll have it however you're having it, Jacques." And I drank it over ice. And I was like, "This is so much better." Whoever bought that bottle of wine, somebody brought that to our house when they were invited over. And I opened it because we had guests who were drinking wine or because I was cooking with it. And then it probably has been in the fridge for 2 to 3 months. So I don't even know if it's good anymore, what to do with it, other than I would probably cook with it again if I needed it.
I'm shocked that Jacques Pepin was cool with that. Or, maybe it's a thing that is fine in France, but we get pretentious about it here.
Right. Well, it was the middle of the afternoon. Maybe that's like his day drinking technique. I don't know.
I had him on this show, and he was telling us how he and Julia Childs would just get completely hammered while they were shooting their show.
Yeah.
Which... It's amazing.
Yeah.
He also, by the way, had bananas like that in his fridge.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he had the brown bananas in the fridge.
Yeah. I bet he got around to cooking them, though. He wouldn't throw them out.
Yeah, Jacques don't fuck around. Yeah, well, all in all, fantastic fridge. Is there anything that you'd like to talk about in the fridge that I haven't touched upon? I will say I love you've got the Tillamook. Is that Tillamook butter or Tillamook cheese?
Butter. Yeah, that's the butter section. We got a variety of butters up there.
Yeah.
Well, if you know, well, so you can highlight on the right hand drawer as you face it, you see Coleman's mustard, which is my all time favorite mustard, that small yellow jar.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I love that plus ketchup on burgers and hot dogs. I love the Coleman's on meatloaf. It's just it kind of has a bit of a wasabi spice to it. I freaking love Coleman's mustard.
And do you ever use the Coleman's powdered mustard?
I haven't because I understand that gives you a little more flexibility, you know, to adjust the ratios of how thick and how strong the flavor you want. Have you tried it?
Yeah, I've used it in some dressings. I think the only reason I have it is because Thomas Keller has in his ad hoc cookbook, I believe, is like a recipe for coleslaw, which is a fantastic coleslaw recipe, and he uses the mustard powder in it.
I could see that being good. I will put that sometimes in my potato salad. Like when I make potato salad, I go very easy on the mayo, and I use mustard. And sometimes I'll do Coleman's if I'm feeling a little saucy.
Yeah, I like that. You've got some fun Asian ingredients here. It seems. Is this like some sort of sambal situation?
That's sambal. That's right. Yep. I got the good oyster sauce there that I got at H Mart. That's got actual oysters in it.
Oh no way!
You can actually taste. There are actual like fish in it. So it's a little bit funky. So it's really, really good. If you look in the top shelf on that door, that's a papaya Scotch bonnet pepper hot sauce that I got. I was doing a Sporkful podcast taping in the Bronx featuring these guys from Ghetto Gastro, which is this sort of like culinary collective based in the Bronx. They sort of do events and all kinds of different artistic collaborations. And I was up there eating with them in a few different spots that have sort of been inspirational to them in the Bronx. And one of the places had this hot sauce like on all the tables. And it was so freaking good. I was like, do you guys sell this? And they said, sure. So I bought like 6 bottles. I brought it to all the Sporkful producers and friends. And it is just, I mean, Scotch bonnet peppers to me are like my all-time favorite hot peppers. So if I can get my hands on any kind of Scotch bonnet hot sauce, I will. But this one has papaya, so it's a little bit thicker and fruity, but also still very spicy. It blows me away.
Is it like a Jamaican thing?
Yes, it's from the Caribbean. I'm not positive which Caribbean. I mean, there's more than one Caribbean island where you'll find Scotch bonnet peppers. Definitely Jamaica is one of them. Trinidad, I know also. So it kind of depends on where you're at.
God, I wish you don't know the name of it, do you?
The brand?
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to wait a minute, I can crawl up the stairs.
Yeah, well, I mean, we can wait. I'd like to give them a shout out.
I'm going to go up upstairs. I'll be back. Just give me a couple minutes because I'm on my crutches.
Oh, shit. Wait, I forgot about the crutches. God damn it. I feel bad now. He's on crutches. Dan and I both have broken... I broke my ankle. He had to get foot surgery. We're both in the same boot doing this podcast for you people. Okay? I hope you're enjoying this amazing content. The man is risking his life to go get you the name of this Scotch bonnet hot sauce. Better fucking buy it.
Okay. Can you hear me? All right, I'm back.
By the way, Dan, I totally forgot you were in crutches for a reason. And as you were like, hold on, it's going to take me a while, I'm on crutches, and you took your headphones out, I was like, no, wait, it's okay.
It's all right. It turns out that my wife left the dog in the backyard, and she was barking to come in, I realized. So it's
okay.
It's fine. Don't worry about it. So I have it here, Dan. It is Matouk's West Indian Hot Sauce.
Matouk's. It looks like... It's got that Aladdin font, Matouks.
Yeah, it's manufactured in Trinidad and Tobago.
Very cool.
Now that I'm looking at the bottle again, I remember, like, I actually Googled it. Like, I couldn't even, I don't know if I even found it. Let me see. Yeah, you can find it. It's online, but it's not easy to find, but you could definitely get it shipped to your house.
One of my favorite hot condiments is from India, something called Nirav. It's like extra hot mango. It's a mango thing as well. Man, it blows me away, and it's so hard to find. Like, you can only get it from some weird website that you, like, know they're going to steal your credit card number from. But it's so good. But I also found the sauces that I was talking about. But it's all these different ones. Yeah, so this one is my favorite. There's, like, a grated daikon and pepper, this yellow one.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's very cool. So It's wasabi, karashi, citron pepper, momizi, oroshi, which is the grated daikon and pepper, and grated ginger. I mean, it is a fun little pack. It's $12 on Amazon. Pretty fun to have.
That looks amazing.
So you started off as a radio person, and then you ended up being like a food radio god. What was that transition like? Were you always a food nerd, or you kind of learned how to be one?
I mean, I grew up in a food-obsessed family. I always loved food. I always loved to eat. And I always had a very kind of obsessive personality. So I always was the kind of person who would like analyze everything in great detail, whether, you know, food or otherwise. But, you know, because I loved to eat and was passionate about food, a lot of my obsessiveness and general attention to detail was focused on food. So even before I got into food podcasting, my friends would tease me. We'd go to the diner, like after, you know, go out for a night of drinking and come home, you know, go to the diner the next morning. And I was always going to never quite have something that was on the menu. It always involved like assembling some sort of elaborate, like turning an omelet into a sandwich with three different English muffins. There was always a system. I was always kind of playing with my food and building something. And you could always sort of see my friends chuckling, like, what's he going to do this time? I had a lot of opinions about things like, you know, the cheese should go underneath the burger because then the cheese is closer to your tongue. And also it acts as a seal, which prevents the bottom bun from turning soggy. So I had all these kinds of like, you know, half-baked theories. When I decided I wanted to start my own podcast, I knew I wanted to host my own podcast. It was like, what's it going to be about? Most of my work up until then had been in political talk radio, news radio, some comedy stuff, but like it was like topical news, you know, political comedy. But I sort of felt like I don't really need to do a podcast about politics. Like this, I don't know that I have anything. I have opinions, but I don't know that I have anything interesting to say.
Right. There's enough of those.
I thought with food, I'm like, well, actually, I kind of have this quirky approach. And then when I started out on it and got a couple years in with my sort of quirky, obsessive approach to food, I had one of these sort of like usual suspects moments where you look back on all the years and you're like, how could I have ever not known that this is where all these roads were leading? Like, why did it take me so long to see that, you know, what everyone else could see? Like, this is sort of the role I was born to play. So I didn't necessarily, you know, set out understanding this about myself. It was sort of following a hunch. And then I got to a point where I was like, oh, yes, no, this actually makes sense.
Yeah. So you are a big fan of food history, which I am as well. Do you have like a favorite? I feel like whenever I'm at a party, I always have a couple of fun food facts to throw out, fun food stories, historical. Do you have any that are like your go-to, on the tip of your tongue, interesting food history things that people that is a little bit of a mind blower?
I mean, it always depends a bit on the context, but I know, like, you know, I'm very interested in how like a lot of our ideas about what's healthy have actually been shaped by marketing. So like the whole slogan of like breakfast is the most important meal of the day, like that's a marketing slogan that was invented by a guy named Edward Bernays. He's the same guy who came up with the whole like 4 out of 5 doctors agree that like this is the best toothpaste or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. that whole like he invented that, and he would go to some doctors and do this sort of like a quasi scientific study, but not a legitimate scientific study, but just enough that he could say like 4 out of 5 doctors. He might have only asked 5 doctors, but 4 of them gave him the answer he wanted. So he said 4 out of 5. so he was hired, I think, by Hormel to sell bacon. And he went to some doctors and was like, you know, do you agree that, you know, people should eat breakfast? That people should eat breakfast, right? They were like, yeah, sure, eat breakfast. And he was like, and don't you think that like bacon, like that would make for a very hearty breakfast, don't you think? And they were like, yeah, sure. And then he sort of like took out these ads in newspapers that were dressed up to look like articles. And they would say, you know, trumpet these headlines, doctors say a hearty breakfast is the most important meal of the day. Start your day with Hormel bacon. And so that is where we get the old idea that breakfast is the most important meal of the day.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And now it's all intermittent fasting, like stay away from breakfast.
Right.
4 out of 5 doctors say that intermittent fasting is the best thing for you.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
That's an interesting one.
How about you? What's one of your go-tos?
You know, I love oldie but a goodie is the quinine in a gin and tonic was made to stave off malaria.
Wait, that's true or that's a myth?
No, that's true.
Oh.
That's true. The British military in South America, they needed to have more quinine because it was the only way to fight off malaria, but they didn't want to take it. So being Brits, they were like, just mix it with gin and you'll be fine. And so quinine is the main ingredient in tonic water.
It's like the iodine in the salt.
Yes. It is the iodine in the salt for goiters. Although I feel like I don't see any goiters anymore, and I rarely see iodized salt anymore.
Yeah, maybe we're getting enough iodine elsewhere. But like it does make you wonder, like maybe we should get back to that. Like, you know, how much easier would the last years have been if they had just, like, put the COVID vaccine in the drinking water?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Just don't put even it in... make it a debate. Let's not even talk about it. What could go wrong? Sneaking it... medicine into the drinking water? It'd be great.
Put it in a Reese's peanut butter cup. And
yes.
Everyone would have been vaccinated in 12 hours. it's so true. Instead of having to wait in a line to get injected.
I just... know, right. You got these parents showing up at school board meetings. Don't vaccinate our kids. Sorry, your kid ate a peanut butter cup at lunch. It's done.
Oh, it's in peanut butter cups? Okay. I'll take one. That's funny. So who is the most exciting person that you've met through your travails in podcast space? That because I feel like this is the thing that you and I have in common is that we know food pretty well. And so we can weave our way into conversations by using food. And people that, you know, we probably have no business talking to, we end up talking to because it's our angle. It's what we got.
I had Weird Al on a number of years ago. That was very exciting. I mean,
that's good.
Weird Al was amazing. I'm trying to think of other, I mean, you know, I don't know if you feel this way. Like I was a radio producer for 10 years before I started my own podcast.
Yeah.
And I met a lot of famous people as, you know, when I was working behind the scenes, you know, at NPR or Air America Radio or Sirius XM, like, you know, a lot of famous people came through the doors. And, you know, I didn't get quality time with them. I don't pretend to like know them, but like even in a brief interaction, you're just sort of like, "Oh, you're a human being." And maybe I just get jaded, but I sort of like I think that I certainly there are certain people who I'd be intimidated by, but I also feel like as an interviewer, I think that when you go to interview a famous person, if you start off by being like, "Oh my God, you're amazing, I worship you," it immediately kind of alters the dynamic of the conversation. Mm. It probably makes them put up their guard a little bit because it puts the two of you then are not like on equal footing. Mm. And so I sort of make a concerted effort when I'm interviewing someone famous to like, I sort of like try to put up a wall in my head and kind of forget who they are. And I try very hard, especially early in the conversation, to be like very kind of...
You insult them. You start out with an insult.
Do you know how much you suck? No, just like to really make an effort. To talk to them about very mundane things. Like, because it makes the interaction feel more like a normal everyday talk that isn't high stakes and that I'm not, you know... And I think that it allows that person to feel like, oh, we're two equals talking to each other. And so because of that, I think I almost convince myself this person isn't famous. Then after the fact, someone will be like, "You talked to that person? How were they? What were they like?" And I'm like, "They were really nice. It was fine." You know, like,
yeah, I told Barack Obama his tie sucked. And then we started. Yeah, I mean, that's funny. That is actually a very smart way to go about it. I feel like I do the opposite. I do kind of geek out on them. But the funny thing is I know a lot of famous people from being an actor and a writer, but food famous people were always the ones that actually got me starstruck.
Right.
So I feel like when I interviewed Ruth Reichel, I must have sounded like I was like such a fanboy. And then like with Henry Winkler, I was like, fine. But it's, I feel like coming from the stand-up world, we're so used to building people up before we introduce them on stage.
Right, right.
And so that's like kind of...
I think it's also kind of like LA entertainment industry default way of interacting, which is like everybody's out there hustling and doing their best to get their careers jump started. And so everyone's always kind of giving each other pep talks of like, "You're doing so amazing. You're doing so great." And like, you are. And like that. So like it's well intentioned and it's a nice thing to say and all that. But I think that like it almost sort of becomes a reflex at a certain point. You just be like, "You're amazing. No, you're amazing."
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with it. It's just sort of like, you know, I think from the listener's perspective, like if you can get people to talk more like regular people, it will be a little, you know, and then it puts a different tenor on the conversation.
Yeah, I think you're right. Now would be a good time to tell you I hate your sweatshirt. It's awful. It's gross. Edward Bernays, the guy who invented the "breakfast is the most important meal of the day" expression, also created another food-related PR win that is now referred to as the guilt barrier. Betty Crocker came up with an instant cake mix that nobody was buying. Bernays set up a focus group for the target market, American housewives, and he concluded that they felt an unconscious guilt for using a product that required so little effort to make. Ah, the 50s. The answer? Give these guilt-ridden housewives a greater sense of participation by requiring them to add an egg to the mixture. Sales suddenly soared as cracking an egg tickled the depths of the subconscious and removed the barrier of guilt. So I'm going to start asking I'm going to get to the questions that I ask every guest, starting with, what is your earliest food memory?
I mean, you know, I probably have to go back to Tuesday and Thursday nights. Those were the nights that my mom worked late. So she didn't cook and the babysitter would make. And Tuesday nights was cottage cheese pancake night. Cottage cheese pancakes, like an Eastern European thing, maybe Jewish. Probably Jewish.
Jew adjacent, yeah.
Yeah. Cottage cheese pancakes, like savory pancakes. You don't eat them with syrup. We just ate, you know, they're really good. Like cottage cheese and sour cream, eggs and flour.
Is it like a deconstructed blintz?
It probably is the same family, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
It'd be cottage cheese, flour, egg, salt, a little sugar. They're a little bit sweet, but they weren't like American breakfast pancakes. They were more savory, very delicious. Loved those. And then Thursday night was hot dog night, and my brother and I have hot dogs, and then always with like steamed broccoli or steamed string beans that we would dip into ketchup.
Mm.
And so those are very, I don't eat as many cottage cheese pancakes these days as I would like to. Once in a while, I'll get the craving and I'll make it for my family. I do really like them, but we eat a lot of hot dogs though.
Got it. So what is your death row meal? So let me think of a reason you're on death row. How about you, the Fusilli people hear this episode and they're like, we gotta get this guy our Fusilli. And they show up at your door with just fucking boxes of Fusilli and you're like, God damn it. And you grab a bunch of your big ass Fusillis that you have and you just like shove them in their mouths and they all like asphyxiate and choke on Fusilli, and now you're on death row. What is your death row meal?
You know, the best shape for that though would be a shape called Strozza Preti, which literally means the priest strangler.
It means what?
The priest strangler.
Okay.
Because supposedly, like, gluttonous priests would gorge on this pasta shape to the point that they would almost choke, as legend has it. But it is a great name, Strozza Preti. Strozza Preti.
That's amazing.
So, but okay, let's say I find a way to kill some people with some Fusilli. Death row meal, it would probably involve flour tortillas. Fresh, homemade, like made within a minute or five of eating flour tortillas. To me, I always have flour tortillas in my refrigerator. It's my go-to. Like if I have any kind of leftovers, meats or vegetables, and I have them for lunch the next day, wrap them in a flour tortilla. Roast broccoli, leftover, take a flour tortilla, mozzarella, chili crisp, microwave it, put in the broccoli. That's lunch.
Mm.
If I have dal and I'll take flour tortillas in lieu of like a more traditional Indian bread and run it through the dal and pinch that with my fingers and eat it that way. And every culture has some version of a flour tortilla. They're a little different, but like there's so many different versions of those sort of doughy, chewy encasements, and any cuisine that is serving something like that, I love it.
I love that. That's a great one. Do you make, and you make your own?
No, I've never made my own. I'm too intimidated and scared. I feel like it would be a lot of work, and I'm positive I'd be disappointed in the results. It's one of those things like maybe when I get older and I'm like, you know, my kids are out of the house and I have like an afternoon to just like whatever, maybe that will be my hobby, is like perfecting my flour tortillas. Right now I buy them at Trader Joe's.
I highly recommend you look into Iran's version of the flour tortilla, which is something called sangak.
Okay.
Which it looks like you've never had it, which makes me envious of you because it's one of the best bread products ever. S-A-N-G-A-K.
I'm looking at it. Wow.
And sangak means little rocks because in Iran they cook it on top of little hot rocks. And so it makes these little divots in it. But it's a fantastic flatbread that's my go-to dip into everything.
Oh my God. This looks amazing.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
It's really, really good.
I really want this now. Yeah. I got a picture here of some woman holding, hanging up whole sheets of it.
Yeah, yeah. Are you? Where do you live? You're in New York?
Yeah, out in the suburbs, outside the city.
Oh, okay. Yeah, my parents live in Great Neck in Long Island. And,
oh, yeah, so there are a lot of Persian stuff there.
Yeah, you can get some pretty good sangak there.
Okay.
So what is the best high-end meal you've ever had?
Best high-end meal I've ever had.
I like it. You're hearing these for the first time, which tells me that your producer or your assistant didn't pass them on like we asked her to.
No, she did pass them on, and I did look through them. But I also sort of like think it's kind of fun to like not think it through too much.
I like that you're getting it off the dome.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is high-end meals usually leave me disappointed. Like, is a high-end meal just like, can that just, like a fancy steakhouse, can that count?
That can count. By the way, you can also give me your worst, if you have a iconic worst high-end meal.
Well, I just, you know, in general, I don't like meals where it feels like the chef is trying very hard to impress me. I don't want to feel like a parent whose kid has come home from school, like, daddy, look what I did. You know, like, it feels like desperate and trying too hard. There's intellectual eating, and then there's sort of, like, sensual eating. Mm-hmm. And you can eat, like, I understand that maybe it's for some people, you can go to a great meal by a great Michelin-starred chef, and they're going to put some foam on something that was freeze-dried, you know, some sort of super high-end thing. And intellectually, you might eat it and be like, huh, that's really interesting. I've never tasted anything like that before. But, like, it doesn't hit you in your gut, just like, yes, that's so freaking good. Right. I want to eat more of that. Like, and those are the meals that I gravitate towards. Like, years ago, I went to WD-50, Wiley Dufresne's place, and I was so looking forward to eating. I saw on the menu they had a rye fettuccine, like fettuccine that tastes like rye bread with shaved pastrami on top.
Yes.
And I was like, oh my God, I love pastrami and rye. He turned it into a pasta dish. That's genius. I can't wait to eat this. And it was like $25 for 4 bites of pasta. And I ate it and was like, you know what would have been better than that? Pastrami on rye.
Right.
So I would say I'm less interested in having sort of a chef blow my mind and more interested in just sort of like having something really good and hearty.
Well, give me the steakhouse meal then.
There was a place, I don't know if it's even still open, a place in New York called Baldoria, an Italian restaurant where they had a steak for two that I was once very hungry and ordered the entire thing for myself. And, you know, I'm not a huge red meat eater. But it's one of the few foods that I will really crave. Like, when I want red meat, I really need a burger or a steak. It's not often, but when the craving hits, it must be satisfied. And when that craving happened to have hit me that night when I was in that restaurant, when I was very hungry and I got the steak for two, and I mean, I just, you know, just perfectly cooked, perfectly juicy. To me, like a great steak, the more you eat it, the hungrier you get.
Well, I've got some bad news for you. Once that craving hits you, you can no longer go to Baldoria because it is closed.
Oh, bummer. Well, next time.
Although it looks like there is one in Long Beach, so you just have to... There was one on... It was on West 49th, I'm assuming, the one you went to. Now it's in Long Beach, Long Island.
Oh, that's odd. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Which might be closer to you. I don't know.
Yeah.
Might be a good thing. What is your favorite drunk food? What do you drink, by the way? What, you said spirits and beer mostly?
Yeah, I mean, recent years I've been on a big tequila kick, so I've been drinking more tequila. Sort of tequila and soda with lime juice is one of my favorites, or a good beer, you know, but I don't like the super hoppy, quadruple hopped IPA situations.
Agreed.
So some combination of those.
Yeah, they've got the hoppiness in beers have jumped the shark, and also the names they're like hop genocide. I'm like, I don't want to be drinking hop genocide.
Right, right. And how many more beers do we need that basically all taste the same?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I like that sour beers are having, or I mean, I don't know if the moment is done, but it does seem like people are getting more into sours and ciders and stuff like that.
Have you heard of back home beer?
Yeah, the Iranian one, right?
Yes, yes. This is a Persian-American beer. They have a couple different flavors. They're based in Brooklyn. I think they only sell in New York and D.C. right now, and I don't think they can ship. But next time you're in New York, track down some back-home beer. They have like a Persian lager with blue salt added that's fantastic. They've got another one, a sumac goza,
yeah,
that's tart and really, really nice.
That's so cool. Yeah, I've been going back and forth on Instagram with them because I'm like loving
what they're
doing.
Yeah, she's great.
Their flavors are Zara. Very cool. I think they serve their beer at what's that Persian restaurant in New York? The one
Cafe Mogador.
No. Mogador, I think, is, I don't know if Mogador is Persian. No, it's the it's that woman. She's getting all the, everyone gives her all the awards. She's got two places in Brooklyn now.
I know I had back home beer at Cafe Mogador.
It is called Sofre. That's it.
Oh, I'll have to check that one out. I don't know that one.
Sofre. Yeah, everyone. She's making some pretty cool food there. She's kind of modernizing Persian food. Cool. All right. So what is your favorite drunk food?
I would go with my own patented grilled egg and cheese sandwich. So this is, think of it like a standard grilled cheese on white bread with the, you know, the outsides griddled in butter, crispy and golden, but with like a scrambled egg patty in the middle.
So you're saying that you can perfect on the bodega egg and cheese sandwich?
I mean, I think mine's pretty damn good, I gotta say. You know, so what I do is I cook the eggs first and I form the scrambled eggs into patties. So if I'm making, you know, however many rectangles, put them aside, and then I build the grilled cheese sandwiches with the butter on the outside, cheese on both sides, and then the eggs in the middle. And then I put the whole sandwich back into the pan to brown both sides and to kind of press it down, fuse it, let the cheese melt in to fuse together with the eggs so it becomes a cohesive whole. Golden brown and crispy on the outsides. Cut it on the diagonal. Grilled egg and cheese.
Mmm. You do ketchup, any of that stuff?
I don't, but I wouldn't fault someone who did. You know, maybe hot sauce too. Good hot sauce.
Yeah. I like the hot sauce and an egg and cheese. My problem is I can't do hot sauce and coffee. And I'm typically having hot sauce or an egg and cheese in the morning with my coffee. So this is my struggle in life with breakfast burritos, with egg and cheeses.
This is a big problem, Dan.
It's the biggest struggle I've ever had in my life.
We need to start a GoFundMe for you.
Thank you.
I'm not a huge breakfast eater, so even if I was going to eat a breakfast burrito, it'd probably be more like at noon, so maybe I could do it between coffee sips.
I mean, that's crazy because 4 out of 5 doctors say breakfast is the most important meal of the day. You're just ignoring the doctors at this point.
I know, screw them.
Now, is that egg and cheese the same as your hangover cure?
Yes. Yeah. Okay, got it. Both. Yes.
Got it.
At any point in the drinking process,
right?
The grilled egg and cheese will be there for you.
Once the drinks start, the eggs are taken out of the fridge. What is? Who is your favorite celebrity food personality?
You know, I think I would probably go with Guy Fieri.
Interesting.
I feel like there's some highbrow folks who like to crap on him, and I think it's unfair. I think that he has done a lot for mom-and-pop restaurants with Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. He's featured a wide range of cuisines and people in small towns and all different folks from different backgrounds on that show. I also I'm biased. I was on Guy's Grocery Games years ago, and like he was just like super nice. And I was like, oh, I'd love to have him on my podcast sometime, thinking he'd be like, okay, talk to my publicist, and I'd never hear from him again. But he like gave me his cell phone number, and I texted him, and he didn't have a publicist for me to talk to. But like it happened, he came on the show. He didn't need to. He doesn't need me. I have nothing to offer him. But just like super nice, and you know, I feel like, you know, like when Guy Fieri and Alton Brown were kind of like the two top people on Food Network, I thought of them as sort of being like the Andre Agassi and Pete Sampras duo. You know, when Andre Agassi and Pete Sampras were the top two tennis players, and Agassi had his fluorescent shirts and his spiky hair, and Sampras was very sort of like dressed in all white, very straight-faced. You know, there were a lot of people in tennis who thought like Agassi was sort of like a showman, a jerk, you know, a punk, and Sampras was the classy one. And over time, what anyone who follows tennis at all has learned is that Andre Agassi actually was universally beloved. Maybe I shouldn't say, well beloved, super nice, sweet guy. And Pete Sampras was a total asshole. Everyone hated Pete Sampras, okay? He was a jerk. He would always make other people pay for his stuff and say he was going to pay them back and never pay them back. He owes everyone in professional tennis money. He's a jerk. So it's kind of like L.A. and San Francisco. People have this unfair stereotype of L.A. as being like, oh, that's the gaudy Hollywood place, and San Francisco is like the gritty place with soul and history. But actually, I find San Francisco to be kind of soulless and empty, and L.A. to have a lot of interesting culture. So I think that there's this duality with Guy Fieri and Alton Brown as well, where like I think certain highbrow people think of Alton Brown as the intellectual sort of high class one, and Guy Fieri as this sort of like dumb red state gorilla, and I think that's very unfair, and that he's knowledgeable and generally speaking a nice person who does a lot of charity work.
So I get that that's your philosophical answer for who is your favorite food personality.
Yeah,
you're being a little bit of a social justice warrior by telling us how great Guy Fieri is. But on a day-to-day basis, whose content you would actually be consuming and waiting, and I am on bated breath waiting for whatever this person is putting out, is it still Guy Fieri or is it someone else?
There's no one super famous in the world of food who I honestly don't. I'm not.
It can be a chef as well. It could be like
I'm not a very avid consumer of food media, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I'm not that interested in it, which I guess probably like informs my podcast and our perspective, you know, for better or worse, depending on what you're looking for in your podcast. There's a food writer at Eater named Bettina McElintal who I really, really like, and I would like read every article that she writes because I think she always just has really good insights and is very perceptive and just, you know, everything you want a good writer to be. Like, she just sort of sees trends, identifies them, and has interesting things to say about them. But in terms of like big food celebrities or chefs, there's not anybody whose work I consume that avidly. You know, I also sort of feel like I worry about inadvertently copying people. So like I also sort of stay away for that reason.
Well, I gave you what it seems like five options now to say Dana Dute, and you you didn't take any of them.
I don't even listen to my own podcast, Dan. What do you want?
What is your desert island food? So you're trapped on a desert island. One food you're going to eat for the rest of your life. You will never get tired of it.
I'd probably say cheese.
Cheese?
Yeah. I mean, like, does that have to be a specific kind of cheese? Or can
no.
I have all the cheeses?
Actually, that's good because it is a very versatile food. Someone once said a pig, because with a pig, you can make like 30 different things.
Cheese. I mean, yeah, I mean, I was going to say, you know, like, I flour tortilla, I feel like wouldn't be filling enough for my one food. I need something that's going to be a little more hearty.
Yeah.
But, you know, cheese, and this deserted island, I'm assuming that it's a tropical deserted island. If I was, like, in the North Sea and I'm, like, by Scotland, maybe I would want a pig or a sheep or something. Something that I could also sleep inside on cold nights.
You could sleep inside. You could take a bunch of Parmesan wheels and turn it into a sleeping bag. Is there a specific favorite cheese if you had to bring two or three cheeses with you?
I was in France a couple years ago with my wife, and I fell in love with a cheese called Morbier.
Yeah.
That's still very high on my list. I mean, to me, though, I don't know if there's anything that I like better than really good fresh mozzarella. I mean, made within the last few hours, cannot have been refrigerated, ideally still warm from being made. And when you slice into it, the milk just comes like pouring out. And just like that, plus, I mean, if I wasn't on my deserted island, I would have a loaf of bread with it. Mm. And the cheese and the bread. There's an Italian market here on Long Island where I live called Uncle Giuseppe's. They have great fresh mozzarella. When I go shopping there, I will get my groceries. I'll get like a 1 pound ball of mozzarella and a loaf of bread. And then I will sit in their little cafe area and that'll be my lunch. I'll take a plastic knife and just work my way through a pound of mozzarella and half a loaf of bread. And that's my lunch. And it is glorious.
Oh my God. I'm picturing you just like sitting in the corner of this like, shanty little, like, they just put like a bunch of plastic chairs and someone walks by is like, Dan Pashman, is that you? And you're like, look away.
Yeah. And no, you can't have it in my mozzarella.
I actually went recently to Torisi, the new Torisi restaurant, which is, you know, the fancy hot spot in New York. But take away all the fancy hot spotness, take away all the celebs, they were making made to order balls of mozzarella. That you see the guy just like, you know, working it, right? And then it comes to your plate and it's slightly hotter than warm because it just came out of the boiling or the hot water. And man, it brought me to tears. It was so good.
It's incredible. And once you've had mozzarella like that, I would never just buy ordinary fresh mozzarella in the supermarket. And I would never order it in a restaurant unless it was like the situation like you described, because 99.9% of the time you order any mozzarella type appetizer salad, like, it was not made. It's been refrigerated. Once right. The mozzarella has been refrigerated, it's half dead. It will never be the same again. And so, yes, tasting mozzarella like that has made me a mozzarella snob.
Is there a food that you can't stand eating?
I'm very moody when it comes to like raw shellfish.
Whoa.
Oysters, clams. Like when the mood hits me, I like it, but like it's a very odd thing. Like once or twice a year, I'll be somewhere and they'll be on the menu and I'll be like, "I want oysters." But other than that, they're just kind of weird and gross to me. And then all of a sudden, once or twice a year, a switch flips. I don't get it.
Yeah. Raw clams are definitely tough. They are a tough food to take down. And it's funny, you can probably relate to this. I grew up kosher. And so when I took a walk on the wild side, the first shellfish that I ate was my fucking friend Dan Steingart took me to this restaurant. And it was like a giant, it was like a Chinese restaurant in Chinatown, like hardcore. And it was a giant raw clam.
Oh,
like
yeah, that's not, I mean, maybe someday that would be delicious for you, but that's not a great place to start.
No.
That's not a good first shellfish experience of your life.
No, it was awful. I wanted to like run to the nearest Chabad and like apologize. All right, last question. This is my favorite question. What is or what are your restaurant pet peeves?
Pretentiousness and...
In what way? Like, give me a
just from the minute you walk in the door. Like, you know, the tenor of the people when you walk in the door should not be that, like, you're so lucky we let you in. It should be like, we're so happy that you're here. And they should treat every single person who walks in the door like that. You know, the James Beard, for whom the awards are named, the great food writer and critic, was once asked, "What's your favorite restaurant?" And he said, "Whichever restaurant loves me the most."
Right.
And that, you know, like to me, like hospitality is everything. Like I would go back, like if I go to a restaurant that makes me feel good and feel welcome, I'll go back to that place, even if the food wasn't amazing. On the other hand, if the food was amazing and they're jerks, well, maybe I would still go back, but I'd shake my fist at them. I also just, you know, like boring shit on the menu. You know, like I don't need another, please, the you see certain dishes, it's like as if suddenly they need to be on every restaurant menu, like the beets and goat cheese salad, the raw tuna, whatever.
Yeah, the hamachi crudo.
I mean, you know, I live on Long Island, and it's like you almost can't operate a restaurant if you don't serve fried calamari. I mean, if you have a taco restaurant, you need a fried calamari taco. And I love fried calamari sometimes, but like we don't need it at every restaurant. You know, we could go to the Italian restaurants for those. But on Long Island, you know, because there's so many Italian Americans, I think you just got to kind of, like, you know, you got to cater to that audience. So,
right.
Yeah, just sort of like that kind of boring stuff. And overcooked burgers. If I say rare, come on, just make it rare.
That's a good one. I think one of my new pet peeves, which I'm workshopping, is I don't know why the Japanese name of the fish is used for a lot of the fish in non-Japanese restaurants. And my buddy Max turned me on to this because he went to some – there's a new restaurant here called Salty Girl in Los Angeles, which is the fancy – it's like the hot new – like, you know, they take the Boston kind of lobster a clam shack but, like, make it fancy and, you know. And their sea urchin on the menu is they write uni. And he's like, why is it uni? There's nothing Japanese about the preparation.
Right.
There's nothing Japanese about the way. Why do they call it uni? And I was like, huh, I never thought about that. And then you realize, like, they do it with hamachi instead of yellowtail, like, in things that are just have nothing to do with the Japanese preparation.
Right. It's just because people think of it as being somehow more high-end and they can charge more for it, probably. Years ago, I interviewed this guy, Doug Sohn, who used to run a famous sausage joint in Chicago called Hot Doug's. And he said the most valuable lesson he learned in culinary school was that you can only charge $1 for a side of peas, but if you call it petit pois à la française, you can charge $3.75.
That is so good. I think we'll end on that. Dan, thank you so much. They say don't meet your heroes, but they are wrong. It is a pleasure to meet you. And
you too.
Tell the people where they can find you, what you're up to, all that stuff.
Yeah, Sporkful Podcast. Get it wherever you get Green Eggs and Dan. And I hope you'll listen and check it out. And if you want to check out my pasta shapes, they're all available through Sfoglini. You can order online. They'll ship the whole pack of all my shapes to your door. It's sfoglini.com.
Amazing. And I shouldn't have just said don't meet your heroes because that made it weird that you're not supposed to make people.
No, you can do it at the end. I just feel like it's not a good thing to say at the beginning.
No, I'm just going to end it by saying, fuck you, Dan. No, I hope your foot gets better and hopefully.
Yours too. Your ankle too.
Yeah, we can see each other without our boot, without the Aircast boot. Pleasure. Yeah. Thanks again, Dan.